My guest this week has been in the talent industry since 2001 and leads the McKinsey Eason consulting firm. His motivation is to fundamentally change the way organizations do business by focusing on building a strong culture around an organization's talent. Darren George is a frequent industry expert and media contributor in the talent and human capital management space. If you haven't read his book, Broken Handoff, you can check it out on Amazon.
Matt McGee is an employee of Frost Insurance. All opinions shared by Matt or guests of the Healthy Conversations podcast are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Frost Insurance or Frost Bank. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for insurance, banking, or investment advice. Healthy Conversations with Matt McGee is brought to you by Straight Up Podcasts.
Darren, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We can jump right on in. Tell me a little bit about McKinsey Eason and what you've been up to.
McKinsey Eason is we're a consulting firm and an executive search firm. So we do consulting on talent acquisition, talent development, talent management, culture. And then we have an executive search side that we do C-level positions for clients.
Awesome. Did you start that company or was that one that you just stumbled into or?
Started it when almost right out of college, about a year and a half out of college. Actually about 2.5 years out of college. I was, I think, 24, 25.
That's pretty young. That's awesome. What led you to start that?
The guys that I was working for, I thought were crooks, honestly.
What were you doing?
I was doing executive search, and I was on the sell side, and the goal was to go out. I traveled to California every couple weeks. I'd be out in California for a week and then back for 2 weeks, you know, I mean, just over and over and over. And it was doing executive search in physicians, healthcare. And it just, the guys that were running it, it was a scheme. You were supposed to go out. We would bring in 10x the number of searches that they could fill on the other side, on the recruiting side. And so, and once I figured that out, I was like, okay, I think I can do this a lot better.
Yeah.
So I started for two reasons. One, I wanted to work closer to home. I was driving to Las Colinas, and that's for the birds. And then two, I thought I could just do things a lot better. There's a number of improvements that I thought you could make in the process, as well as from a standpoint of working with candidates, working with clients. And that's sort of been my mantra that's what started our consulting division was everything that we had done on the executive search side. We found that clients just weren't really good at knowing how to interview people, how to choose the right fit. So it really spurred our consulting side for talent acquisition, talent development, talent management.
What helped really shape your approach to business? I was looking at your website and noticed you really focus on culture, vision, core values to find the right talent. Was it those first couple of years seeing how other people are doing it and doing it wrong and you wanted to do it differently? Or what kind of led to that unique approach?
Yeah, it really comes down to my why it matters is to constantly improve things. So how can I take something and improve upon it? So it's a better process, better, you know, fit, whatever. And so one of the things, that is just totally missing and still is in most HRs today, they just truly don't understand what HR is about. To most companies, HR is about rules. I call HR
compliance.
Yeah, it's about compliance. I call HR human rules. And most HR functions don't understand how to make HR into a profit center versus a cost center. And so for me, it was like, look, if you find great people and you focus on these three things, your core values, your culture, right, and the vision of the organization, you can sell that and find the right person that's going to be with your company. They're more productive. They're going to stay longer. There's just so much that goes into it. And those are the three factors right there. If you can align those three, And still, I mean, most companies don't know how to do that very well, if at all.
Yeah, I totally agree. How have you seen companies kind of incorporate those three successfully? I mean, are there any good examples here in town that you might give a shout out to that are really, that have figured out how to turn HR into that profit center, just because that seems very counterintuitive. I would say a lot of companies that I've seen are more from that rules compliance. And then part of that is recruitment and retaining talent. So that seems very different than the way a lot of companies are operating.
So you know, there's not really a size of company that fits. It's just whether it's a priority.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of C-level executives that still look at HR, and probably rightfully so, in a lot of the companies they've been in, as not having a seat at the table. And it's because they don't know how to turn HR into a profit center. And by that, what I mean is, how do you make the company, the people, more productive and more profitable? And that's really hard to do. It's a shifting dynamic in HR. That most companies just still don't know how to do. They're still stuck in that traditional HR where it's about rules, compliance, benefits. And those are all cost centers. Those do not help the bottom line.
Yeah.
What you have to do is shift the dynamics to a more talent-oriented organization focused on culture, retention, finding the right fit. There's a ton of research that shows that if you have the right fit, they are more productive, which makes your company more profitable. I mean, it's a simple concept. How do you do it? Most places don't know how to align those three. And I'll tell you, a great company that's local that knows how to do it. They're somewhat small, but for an advertising firm, they've grown significantly in size. And the reason is because they align their culture with their business strategy, and their talent is Schaefer Advertising. They have grown so much over the past 5 years, and it's because of that. They know how to find great people. They know how to develop those people, and so they continue to grow. And their clients, it's reflected in their business strategy. It all aligns, and their clients see it, and they've grown just significantly and continue to.
Yeah, I mean, that I've heard of that company, but that's awesome to hear. As far as finding and retaining those top talent, once you have figured out the culture and the strategy, how do you typically go about finding talent in kind of today's hyper-competitive job market?
I have a unique approach about finding talent. If you're talking about how do you attract talent?
Yeah.
Most organizations think it's about, you know, posting on hiring boards and marketing in that respect. And I look at it as you can absolutely find some good talent that way, but the majority of organizations that are going to find great talent are going to go and attract that talent by reaching out to them, by showing what a great culture is, and having people talk about what a great company that is. And it makes you want to go work for them, right? So it's, again, it goes back to that culture fit, and then going out, attracting those, and having an ongoing pipeline where you're just trying to reach out and find the best talent. The best talent typically isn't looking.
Yeah. Right?
The best talent is happy where they're at, and you got to go show them that your organization is a better fit.
Better culture, better strategy.
Exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've done maybe 10 or 11 of these shows at this point. And culture, I would say, it just happens to be, I would say, the most common theme that seems to be coming up in all of these, regardless of if it's healthcare or more just a pure business executive.
And you know the funny thing about that? So it's talked about more than anything right now.
Yeah.
But it's the thing that's least understood by most companies. Most companies don't even know what their culture is. They talk about it in this way that's either aspirational or
a mission statement.
And most of them don't understand what their culture is. and don't know how to align their culture with what their business strategy is. Most of the time when we go in and do consulting, little side note, besides McKinsey's, and I've got a startup that is, it's a software as a service to go and measure a company's culture across the entire organization. And you can see, then we can show you, here's what the C-suite thinks it is. Here's what the front line, the management, different departments, locations. And the idea is there's usually a disconnect between what the C-suite thinks it is, very aspirational, and the front lines. Even then, most organizations still don't understand what their culture is. It's such a squishy thing that people go, oh, our culture is, working with a client who they think their culture is once a month when they go do these dress up happy hours. That's not your culture of your organization. That's a very, very small piece of it. So it's one of the things that people talk about all the time and really, truly still have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit more. Can you share, obviously you guys do consulting on this front. Can you share 1 to 2 tips on a company that might feel like they've got culture figured out, but is doing the happy hour once a month? Somebody that might fall into that bucket of what you should do, or?
Well, I don't want to throw any companies under the bus that I can say, they have a horrible culture.
Yeah, you don't have to say names. I'm just saying some tips on what companies that might be trying to figure out the culture, what they could do.
So culture is really made up of 3 things, right? So the artifacts, it's what you see. It's how people dress. It's what your office space looks like. It's the pins that you maybe, your logo. It's all the things that you see in an organization. Those are called the artifacts. The second piece is what do people say? What do they say and do, right? Those are the things that you see them do, right? How do you treat people? How do you greet people in the morning? And then the third piece is the assumptions behind it. What you want is all 3 of those to align. And then all 3 of those, once you understand what the culture is, all 3 of those should align with what your business strategy is. And there's lots of cultures that, so for instance, you have cultures that are very rigid and rules oriented, very process oriented. You have cultures that are very relaxed, no rules, very innovative, fun work environment. There's no right or wrong. However, does that align with what your business strategy is? So the idea is if you have a strong performance enhancing culture, the return on investment with that, and culture is one of those things, if it's not driven from the top with a very specific, like, this is where we want to go, then it will drive itself, right? So you want to make sure that culture is something that's driven from the top, and you want to make sure it's aligned with your business strategies. Most people just don't know how to do that. And since they don't, and it's a soft, squishy thing, they just don't deal with it. Mm-hmm. They talk about it, but they don't actually do anything to actually make any strides into make sure the culture is the right one, making sure it's a strong performance enhancing culture, maybe make sure that it's a right culture for their specific industry in what they do.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it seems like strategy, I'm sure every company has some form of strategy, but the culture that is driving it seems to be one of those 3 is where they're typically screwing up. Would you agree with that? Is ignoring the squishy part, the what people see, say, and probably more than anything, the assumptions.
The assumptions are behind it, yeah. Right? Are the most important thing.
They're assuming that everybody knows, everybody's on the same page, but if you guys created an entire company to measure, and the biggest thing you guys are seeing is the disconnect between what the C-suite versus frontline.
Let's take an example, right? You have, for instance, the municipality government, which tends to be highly bureaucratic, mm-hmm. very process-oriented, very rules-rigid oriented, because that's what you tend to find in municipal, right? Mm-hmm. Government, et cetera. it's not a right or wrong. That can still be the right type of culture. You still have to drive, right? You can be too far in one of those corners. So in municipalities, for instance, or government, you still want to drive innovation. But a municipality and government should never be like a technology firm that yeah. is constantly driving innovation, because you don't want to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars on something that's unproven, right? That you are putting out there for your constituents to do. So there's no right or wrong type of culture per se. It depends on the industry, depends on the company, but you do want to make sure that you understand that what those three things are, what your real culture is, and do those align with your business strategy.
Awesome. And you work in a number of different industries, from Fortune 50 to government. I mean, are there any trends that excite you that might not be super obvious yet? It might not be in the culture space. It might be more in the talent management that a tech company is doing that, call it, say, banking or a nonprofit has yet to kind of explore at this point.
A couple of the trends that there's a trend, and it amongst Fortune 50 to municipality to small, you know, mid-size and small companies, of moving to more of a, trying to move HR to a profit center, meaning they're trying to move it to a more talent-based organization where you're focused on the talent, and you know that retention, development, and developing people and moving them up through the organization is how you have a robust, very productive, profitable company, right? That's how you can beat your competition. I mean, right there. The other one is data, right? Data analytics. And you're seeing data analytics is something that's talked a lot about.
Yeah.
Most companies aren't using it yet. I mean, for instance, private equity, which one of the private equity is, there's a private equity, it seems like, on every corner these days. And it's, even in private equity, it's very seldomly used on a wide scale basis. But you're starting to see more data analytics used in HR, which is a really great trend that I think will drive a lot of change in HR from that cost center to a profit center over the next 10 years.
And so you think it will help take a lot of the compliance, the rules-oriented things off of their plate, or at least alleviate some of the time that they're spending on it so that they can focus on it? Or
no, you're always going to have the compliance piece of HR.
Yeah, because that seems to just be growing.
Always going to have benefits. You're always going to have your employee benefits. You're always going to have your legal aspect of HR to cover their butt, right?
Yeah.
You're never going to get rid of that compliance, especially as companies grow. However, you can diminish how much it costs to use all of those if you have an HR piece that's focused on talent.
Right? Gotcha. Awesome. One of the things, I go to a lot of Fort Worth HR events, and a lot of conversations nowadays have been around diversity and inclusion and how to incorporate that.
It's a big topic these days.
Yeah. Seems to be coming up in more and more meetings. I mean, given almost two decades in the human capital and HR space, any general advice there?
So that's a complicated...
Yeah, for sure. Definitely a loaded question.
And especially in today's partisan political environment. However, what I always try to go back to, and this is what we've designed all of our processes are designed around, what does research and science say? Look, research and science shows diverse groups of people within organizations show more profitable results. And the reason is, so at all levels, and that's, it's not just, oh, let's bring in, you know, we got to bring in a female person for the leadership team, right? It is at all levels that you have diversity, and diversity is not just color, it's not just, you know, gender, it's different backgrounds, it's different socioeconomic levels. If you have diverse groups of people, at all levels, you get differing ideas. They see things that other people don't see. Great example, I just read about a couple weeks ago. There was Cheetos, right? Was a brand that had basically topped out. It was not seeing increased sales, and they were looking for anybody in the organization to help increase sales. And so they put it out there literally to everyone in the organization and a janitor.
Yeah, I read that article. That was awesome.
Did you read off the Hustle?
Yeah.
And this is a great example, right? This is a janitor who spoke very little English, had been in California and took his job very seriously as a janitor.
Yeah.
And he went home and he put together this sample. And he contacted literally the CEO, because that's what it said. Yeah. And that's a great example of if no one else in the company, all the executives, all the salespeople, and it rattled some feathers, right? You have this janitor that came up with flaming hot Cheetos, which has been one of their best sellers
for years.
And so they even ended up going to be an executive in the company. But it's just a great example that I recognize diversity brings different ideas that you would not normally find.
He went out of his way. He tested it on his family and friends, totally different market. Yeah, that was a great article.
And that sums up exactly why when you have a homogenous group of people, you don't see other ideas. And we live in such a globally connected community now, from the United States to the EU, it's so easy to do commerce across, you know, state, you know, international lines. So you have to understand and get differing viewpoints. That's what diversity is about. Now, inclusion is a little different, right? You want to make sure that there is an equity, that everybody has an ability and chance to grow, learn, develop, and move up. So it's taking and making sure, okay, we have processes in place that we're going to make sure we have a diversity of ideas, people, you know, groups, et cetera. And then the inclusion pieces, are we making sure that, so it's a very complicated subject, but the research and science shows no matter what industry, no matter what business, having a diverse group of people is profitable for your business.
Yeah, agree 100%. We can jump into Broken Handoff. So you just recently co-wrote a book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, again, you know, sort of like when I was young and probably too dumb to know better and started McKinsey Eason, this was sort of a fluke. I was having breakfast with a buddy of mine who's a CEO of private equity, and he was introducing me to a buddy of his, Michael Gordon, who is a serial entrepreneur. And I was telling him an idea that he's like, what do you do? You know, blah, blah, blah. And I was telling him an idea for a new division I had, which turned into this cultural assessment. And he said, and the idea was that private equity firms, there's a lot of money in the market for private equity. Mm-hmm. And my idea was that they don't do any due diligence on human capital and culture. And that's one of the big pieces they're missing when it comes to transactions. And he said, we should write a book. And I sort of laughed and I said, I'm not a writer. He's like, no, we can do this. And he actually, a couple months later, we were all three writing three separate stories and just going to combine them and do self-publishing. And, you know, and the idea was that we had a really good idea of how you can change the M&A market, because 70% of mergers and acquisitions fail, right? That's a lot of money that's lost in the market every single year.
Yeah.
And so we were like, why are people doing it the same every time? Well, it's a lack of knowledge, right? A lot of times entrepreneurs, it's the first time they've done a transaction where they're selling a family business or they've started something and built it so they can sell it. And so they just don't know. And then you have, you know, the private equity and the institutional investor, that they come at from a certain side. They are MBA guys. They are super smart and they understand numbers. A lot of times what they fail to understand is that people who are quirky and don't always follow exactly what you want them to do are the ones that implement all of those growth strategies, right? And so they don't always happen like you expect them to, right? That's that culture and human capital piece that goes into it. And so he was sitting down with the CEO of Brown Books, and she said, it's a great idea. You guys come in and pitch us. And Seth and I were like, whoa, I don't know if we're ready for this. Yeah. And we did, and they said, we're going to publish this. And it turned out to be just a fantastic book. And it's really, really, we hope that it's going to change the market for both institutional investors and entrepreneurs, that it will help with less transactions that go bad. There's just so many transactions that happen out there and I'm talking large transactions to small, where they just end up going bad because
nobody thought about the culture,
right? And then so the private equity firm starts then pushing, well, let's implement these things. The CEO leaves, and then everybody else gets scared, and then they start leaving. There's so many things that go into it. It's an intricate process. Are we going to get that down to 35%? No. But even if we can change the market in 5% and lower it to 65%, when you're talking about, trillions of dollars in transactions, that changes the GDP significantly.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. What was the experience of writing a book like? How long did that take? Was it easier, exponentially harder than you thought?
So we started in February of March of 2017 and had the manuscript done by the end of August. And then it went to the publisher for editing. It was a very fun experience. I wouldn't change it for anything. I would say, and I think my co-authors would agree, that three authors is difficult, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you get down to the end and some of the final pieces of, from the artwork to the cover. I mean, there's just a lot that goes into that. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would do it again. Most likely, if I do it again, I'll probably write one on my own.
Yeah, probably a little easier. Awesome. What was the worst career advice you ever had, and as well, what was some of the best career advice you've ever gotten?
So that's, I'm not sure I can, that's, I'm a good person to answer that, because I was 24 when I started my own company. And so I have not had a lot of people give me career advice. I'm usually the one giving the career advice.
All right, then what was, some of the best advice you feel like you've given, or?
So that's a better question.
Yeah.
I get calls all the time from business associates, friends, acquaintances. Hey, can you talk to a friend of mine?
Yeah. What do you
just
think
out
of this?
College, etc. Yeah. They're trying to figure out what to do, and they come to me and they're like, "Hey, can you help me find a job? Or can you, tell me what I should do?" And I'm like, "No." the advice I always try to boil it down to them is, you have to figure out what you're going to be happy doing. And if you can figure out what you're happy doing, you will be exponentially happier. One. Two, no matter what, when you first start out, I don't care what job it is, it's usually not fun, right?
It is your first job for a reason.
Correct. And there's a lot of research out there, and I tell them this, there's a lot of research out there. You fall in love with your job once you become an expert at it, right? So just whatever you do, do it as best as possible and try to look at what your strengths and weaknesses are. One of the things that I have a great friend that owns a company called Talent Insights. And we're working with a couple of UNT Dallas, to work with some of their students and do these assessments with them to show them at an early age, here's where your strengths and weaknesses are, right? If you are a very detailed person, you want to look into accounting, you want to look into finance, you want to look into some things like that. If you're not a detailed person, you are probably going to be miserable looking at accounting spreadsheets all day long.
Yeah.
Right. So look at some of your strengths and weaknesses before you choose what career you want to go into. And then just be open, because like once you get into and go, okay, well, I'm going to go into finance, it's wide ranging. Focus on trying to be an expert. And that's where you fall in love with your job and you become better. People ask me all the time, well, how did you end up in talent and executive search? And I'm like, I didn't get out of college and go, I'm going to 15 years from now own my own company, being a consultant, telling people how to, you know, hire the best people for fit. I mean, I didn't know that, but as I got into it, you know, you found your niche.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's the one thing, is I just think about what's going to make you happy from just a fundamental, like, do I enjoy influencing people? Do I enjoy pivoting and working on lots of things all the time? Do I enjoy being in the details, or do I not, right? Look at some of those strengths and weaknesses, and that will help you. And then literally there's so many jobs out there that you can then choose and help choose wisely where you're going to be happy and what'll be a best fit for you.
Yeah. I was talking to a buddy last week on the show, and he does learning and development for LinkedIn. And one of the biggest deals they do is a rotational program within LinkedIn. And that seems to be something that larger companies, I think, are a lot better at than, call it your mid-size to small, but they also have the scale, they have multiple locations, it's much easier. But I was kind of surprised to hear that they were moving people around every 2 years, call it, and not even really changing pay that much. I figured with every move, you were getting a significant bump one way or another. But he was saying, no, it's really just about the experience and sitting down with them, having a plan. If they do want to move, creating a plan 18 months in advance. So that was kind of the biggest insight from an upcoming episode.
Yeah. And that's, so you'll find a lot of companies, IBM. So yeah. IBM has a fantastic program where, you know, they'll bring people in right out of college and they're like, hey, listen, we're going to literally rotate you through every 6 months or 3 months.
You're not going to sit at this desk for 5 years and then get a promotion.
Right. And the idea is you get one, a better feel for different departments, different things. So no matter what you go into, you understand how the other ones work, right? Mm-hmm. It's that cross-functional. So you understand what marketing's doing. You understand what finance is doing. So it's a great program. It's a great leadership development program. And that's actually the basis of what most talent development programs in every company should be built on.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't do it.
Yeah. Interesting. I recently read a book about generalists and how those are kind of becoming, or in the future, the value will be put on a broad range of general experiences versus being a specialist. What do you kind of think of that? Or do you think there's still a need? Obviously, there will always be a need for specialists, but not sure if you've read that book or have any thoughts on that.
I think everything ebbs and flows, right? Yeah. There's always going to be a need for specialists and individual contributors. I think what you're seeing is that people realize specialist is only so far you can go down that road and be an expert. And when you do that, you get a lot of silos. So when you have these individual, you know, contributors that are really expert in something, they don't see how that
fits into the big picture.
Everything else.
Yeah.
And so the being able to be generalists like that, especially for smart people that pick up things quickly, you don't need to necessarily be an expert. You can have a smaller number of experts and more generalists that see how everything connects.
Exactly.
And then you go to the expert, hey, I'm having specific, you know, I need help on this, and then help.
Awesome. We can wrap up with a few quicker questions. You're doing a ton of different things. How do you decide what you're focusing on? Do you think of it as like a weekly, or is it, all right, here's my to-do list type deal? How do you think about it given that you're running your own consulting firm, people are calling you, you wrote a book, you started a tech company. How do you kind of think about time and what you focus your energy on?
There's a couple of ways to answer that. One, I feel like most of the time I'm juggling quite a bit. But I think it goes back to one basic principle. Time is money.
Yeah.
And if it's not going to the bottom line, do you need to be doing it right now? I mean, very basic. So I try to live off of that. And then there are different techniques. So I do executive coaching. We provide executive coaching to a lot of clients. And so there's no right way. So for me, I try to look at my week and see how it's scheduled and then have an ongoing to-do list. And it's actually just learned this from a client the other day, that the Eisenhower box, or, you know, is it urgent and is it important? If it is, you focus on it right now. Mm-hmm. If it's important but not urgent, you can do it later.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think it helps with understanding that, because there's a never ending list of to do when you have a 2.5, a 3.5, and a 5.5 year old,
okay,
a wife that you actually enjoy and like to be around, trying to run a full business, a startup, and sit on 5 boards. There's a lot of juggling going on.
Yeah.
So the to-do list never ends. I mean, it just doesn't. As well as, I forgot, a book that just launched, right?
Yeah.
So it's a lot to juggle, and you just have to decide what's, you know, time is money, is going to the bottom line. And now boards and things like that don't go to the bottom line, but I'm a big believer that you have to give back to your community. And Fort Worth's my community, and I love Fort Worth. I end up doing probably way too much pro bono work for, you know, people in the community, but I love Fort Worth, and I think it's very important for people to do that, no matter what. Everyone should figure out a way to give back to their community, whether it's volunteering, whether it's sitting on boards, whether it's something, donating money, something to give back to help improve your community.
Yeah. Any advice there for somebody that might not know where to start, or just figure out what's most important to you and then search that out within your given community?
There's a nonprofit for every passion, right? And I don't care if it's the animal shelter, homelessness, if you're concerned about your city, right? And getting involved in city government, there's boards that you can sit on the city government. There's always something that you can do to give back to your community to make it better.
Awesome. We can wrap up with this one. What is something you believe in that few others do? I've been asking this question the past few weeks, and figured you might have a unique answer, so don't disappoint.
One thing that, are we talking about business? I mean, for me, it goes back to culture. It's something that's talked about, but very few people understand it. And if more companies would focus on culture and understanding it and driving it, it's amazing the results that you see on an ongoing daily basis, from productivity, profitability, to just wanting to work there, like, yeah, showing up. I mean, from leadership down.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is amazing what culture can do. And it's just one of those ones that most people truly don't understand. CEOs don't know how to affect it. They don't know what to do with it. So
they don't touch it.
They don't touch it. They leave it to HR. Yeah. HR doesn't. They're more clueless about it most of the time than the CEO is.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll finish up there. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This was a blast. Appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. It's Matt. Thanks again for tuning into Healthy Conversations. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on iTunes, leave a 5-star rating, or write a quick review. If you really loved it, share the episode on social media. It really helps our iTunes ranking. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.